We are continuing with our series in the Beatitudes. And as I have said before, we have to remember that these Beatitudes are contrary to basic human nature, contrary to human impulses. And so we go through, blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are those who mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the gentle or meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness, for they shall be satisfied, or they shall be filled. We have managed to create a generation in this country that's not particularly well acquainted with hunger or thirst. That is somewhat of a unique circumstance, because all across the rest of the world, and when this was written, people were very well acquainted with hunger and thirst. And Paul, in one of his letters, writes he was often hungry, often thirsty, but he had learned to be satisfied in whatever state he found himself. But this verse comes in a logical order. First, the individual has recognition that he's poor in spirit, or poor in spiritual things. He has a great need for spiritual things, in which he lacks. Then he mourns for the sin that troubles himself and the world, that troubles his society. His approach to God is defined by meekness, because he has an accurate understanding of the state of things. He knows the holiness of God, and he knows the inadequacy of his own righteousness. And so, in desiring fellowship with God, he is hungering and thirsting for righteousness. How do we explain that? How do we explain hunger and thirst to people who, in general, don't know hunger and thirst? At the time the sermon was given, hunger and thirst was understood by the people. Water was scarce, a resource to be cared for in Israel at that time and to this day. And people could, if there was a crop failure, also be hungry, near to the point of starvation. So I'm trying to think of a good example. And I went back a number of years, over 50, to a book I read. It was My Life as an Explorer by Sven Hedin. And this man was exploring along the ancient Silk Road from China. And so he wanted to go into Tibet, and they said, no, you can't come in here. And so he snuck in anyway. And so he's out there with a companion, and they got kind of misplaced out in the desert, and they get close to dying of thirst. And actually, his companion laid down, and probably laid down to die. And he found a strength somehow to go a little further, and he stumbled onto water. He drank all the water he could hold. But they discarded all their equipment. It was too heavy to carry. He didn't have anything on him, and he wanted to take water back to his companion to see if he couldn't save him. So he's thinking of his friend lying out there in the desert. He takes off one of his boots and fills it up with water. And then with one boot foot and one sock foot, he goes back to his friend who's laying there, he sloshes that water around and said, "How would you like a boot of water?" Now, you might not want to drink a boot full of water that someone's sweaty foot had been in for miles on end, but his friend thought it was delicious. And so it revived him enough so that he could manage to walk to the water source and fill up. Now, I'm thinking that these men were thirsty enough, as they were approaching death, actually, to illustrate the point of hunger and thirst for righteousness that's written here. And if you don't have anything to do, if you could ever find it, this book, My Life as an Explorer, is a very interesting book, where this man went, things he saw and the things he did. So righteousness, if we're going to try to define righteousness, it's a life which is in conformity with the will of God. So where he wants you to go, you go. And so if you're looking for an Old Testament example, you can look at Psalm 1, which we read previously. Is a man that does not listen to the counsel of the wicked, but he has a delight in the law of the Lord, and he meditates there. And this law sets forth a number of concepts that were unknown in the ancient world. The first one that comes to my mind is the Sabbath, where you could rest on the seventh day, and especially for the servants and the slaves. Aside from this, there's provisions for slaves to be released after so many years, not to stay in servitude forever. And, you know, if America, which we often brag about, had instituted a law that in the seventh year the slave was to go free, we would have got away from a lot of the evils of slavery that remain to this day. But in our infinite wisdom, we said, not only the slave, but the children of slaves shall be slaves, and the grandchildren. There was allowance for crops to be left in the field for the hungry and the poor of the land. Or there was an allowance for people to be able to eat crops that hadn't been harvested yet. You could eat till you had enough, but you couldn't carry any away. And that was to make sure that people were not hungry. There was careful procedures in the ancient law for due process in judging, so that if there was anybody that was being judged for a supposed or an alleged crime, you had to make sure you had reasonable proof. Much of our jurisprudence is based on some of these principles to this day. There was rules considering lending to the needy. And of course, who can forget the Jubilee year, where any slaves are set free and a man, maybe even by improvidence, that's lost his field, can go and claim it back again and get his inheritance back. And if not his field, then perhaps his father's field, depending on how the generations fall. If this country had adopted the principles of the Jubilee year, then my grandfather, who lost his farm during the Depression, would have been able in the Jubilee year to go claim it back. Think about that for a minute. Many people lost their homes or farms for very small amounts of money during the 30s. But these are things in the law. And these are things I enjoy thinking about and pondering on. Because if you look at some of these provisions, to me they shout not man-made. You don't see the fingerprints of men on these provisions. And so the man who wanted to know God would meditate on the law given by God to understand the character of God. Look at these provisions. Look for the fingerprints there of God and the principles that run contrary to human nature. Man lost his field due to improvidence. What would human nature say? Tough luck, bud. Or you made your bed, now you have to lie in it. But human nature would not say in the Jubilee year, it can be forgiven and you get it back. In the New Testament, in Philippians 3, 7 through 10, Paul recounts the loss of all things that were formerly of value to him. But he doesn't regret the loss. He doesn't look back with sadness. He said, bah, that's all rubbish. I thought it was important then. But when I came to Christ, I had a new attitude. I had a new outlook. Everything changed. And things that were of great importance before became of no importance. And things that were of no importance before became of primary importance. And so he wants to know Christ and the power of his resurrection and even the fellowship of his sufferings. Now we know that Paul was a saved man. He met Christ on the road to Damascus and he knew Christ. But here we see an intense desire to know more, to know him better. And that is part of the definition of a hunger and thirst after righteousness. I know some. He says elsewhere, I see dimly as in a glass. I'm looking forward to when I see clearly and face to face. So I can know even as I've been known. And so if we look around us in society, outside these walls, what would you say people desire above all else? Realistically, what can we say they hunger and thirst for? A very basic desire is for happiness. But how do you achieve that happiness? How do you get from unhappy to happy? In America, probably first on the list is money. You know, there's a man's scramble for money, and people think that will solve all their problems. Secondary to money would be things. Okay, we can look at houses, we can look at cars, we can look at phones. Whenever I have trouble with my phone, I get my grandson to come and fix it for me. He's my technical expert on that. And me and the phone have kind of a toleration sort of relationship. I tolerate the fact that I need a phone and have learned to text a little in some of these things, but I just barely tolerate it. I kind of resent the effect that phones have had on society. Everyone's got their nose in a phone texting somebody somewhere all the time. It's hard to talk to people if they got their nose in a phone. But the smartphones are getting smarter and smarter. Isn't that true? I was in a deacon meeting one time, and I was doing a devotional, and I was talking about Jacob's well. And I said, it's a very deep well. Over at the other end of the table, one of the younger generation. He's going, 172 feet deep, he said. Thus saith Google. And so, cars, phones, jewelry, clothing, many other material possessions, we've come a long distance from the relatively simple lifestyle that might have been our parents, grandparents, great-grandparents. They had stuff too, but they had less stuff. How was it possible for them to live without all these things that we consider indispensable today? My father never had a credit card. All of his life, if he didn't have cash in his wallet, he didn't buy it. And he didn't like the idea of easy credit. We see also people who desire political power or the power to force society to bend to their will. I want you to do it my way. My way is the right way. And so you get demonstrations, you get riots, you get elections, you get the behavior of elected officials. All of it attests to this overwhelming desire to get power, political power, to bend the lives of others to your will. I could speak about other things that people hunger and thirst for, but time would fail me. Quest for youth and beauty. Economic power, where money and power are two different sides of the same coin. The scramble for power in the entertainment world. So you see these various stars that are seriously quoted in the newspaper as if above and beyond capacity to sing and dance, they actually had something going on in their brain that was of importance. Or the terrible fight for power in dark places in the world. You see this in the various criminal enterprises. You see it playing out in Afghanistan even today. Myanmar, China. Spiritual wickedness in high places. If we go in day-to-day life, you know, you can think of events which show things that people really desire. Get the common traffic accident. Guess what? When there's a couple grand worth of damage, nobody is ever at fault. It's always the other guy. And, you know, some of the stories that the troopers get after an accident could get an award not of 5 Pinocchios, but maybe of 50, where people explain why it's not their fault. Another one is the estate after someone passes away, and then there's a scramble over whatever is left behind. In both events, people who seem totally normal will lie like crazy or steal. In one case, to escape liability, which is rightfully theirs, and the other case, to obtain property, which is not rightfully theirs. And both of these, of course, are driven by money or possessions. But we've already said that a very common desire is for happiness, and you get all these things that make people happy. I was dealing with a man in my office one time who was inebriated on the job, you know, and I said, listen, I said, this is very serious. And he told me, drinking is the only thing that makes me happy. That statement has stuck with me for the rest of my life. How sad is it that the only happiness this man could find is out of a brown bottle? It's terrible. But the Sermon on the Mount doesn't speak to these various desires, which in the end fail to satisfy the inner hunger. And if we look at those who have achieved those things, can we say they're happy? If I go back even further in years from the book that I referenced, there's an ancient poem written about a man named Richard Corey, who was very much admired. And a man was saying, oh, I wish I could be like him. You know, he's handsome, he's got money, he's got it all. But the end of the poem is Richard Corey went home and put a bullet in his head. Another good suggested reading. He wasn't happy. He had it all, but he wasn't happy. And many of the people out in the entertainment field or in the industrial field or other places are not happy. We had some missionaries in. We spoke to them the other day, and we were talking about future plans because they're getting up in years. They said, we're going to keep right on doing what we've been doing as long as we can. As much as we can. You know, we don't have any retirement plans. But what we see in these verses is not a quest for happiness. It's a desire for holiness, which is a different thing. And so we see from the text that the man needs to desire righteousness. And this would be a righteousness that can only come from God. We're led to the conclusion by the sequence of verses. The man would understand he's poor in spirit. He would mourn for the sin that separates him and his society from God. And he understands this clearly. He understands there's separation, there's a wall there, but he wants to breach the wall. He wants righteousness. He has an intense desire for it. And we explain this by saying he hungers and thirsts after righteousness. He wants a fellowship with God. Well, how would we satisfy this hunger? We know that Jesus was teaching, and his teaching was diverging from the religious experts of the day. Well, the experts don't always know everything, and the self-proclaimed experts don't always know everything. They were known for their list of rules from the law and from tradition. And it was said they built fences around the law so that someone couldn't get close to breaking the law if they observed the fences. And Jesus said later in his same sermon, unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you shall in no way enter the kingdom of heaven. And they complained that Jesus and his disciples didn't follow their traditions. And then Jesus pointed out where their tradition diverged from the law. He said, the law says this, but you say that. And so we should look at their ideas and contrast them with his ideas. And a good summary of current ideas from the religious class of the day, and unfortunately for some of the religious class right now today, would be in the prayer of the Pharisee. Luke chapter 18, he said, God, I thank thee I'm not like other people, swindlers, unjust, adulterers, or even like this publican. I fast twice a week. I pay tithes of all I get. And of course, that's only a small, small sampling of the long, long list of rules that the Pharisees had. We also know that the publican who said, Lord, be merciful to me, a sinner, he went down to his house justified rather than the Pharisee, because he knew he was spiritually poor. He was mourning for the fact that he was spiritually poor. Now, it's common for human beings to make up a list. From the time I went to elementary school, through college, and out in the workplace, there was always a list. These things you do, these things you don't do. Punch your time card on time. Don't be late. Make sure that the work is of a certain quality. There's always a list. And in large measure, people like a list, because when you get through the list, then what? You're done. The goal has been reached. And it's also human nature to compare ourselves to others. And we like to do it where the comparison is flattering to us. Oh, he does this, but I don't do it. Okay. Or I do this, and he doesn't do it. And so we can see that a list can be coupled also with a measure of contempt for the people who what? Don't measure up by our list. Oh, he does this or that. He's got to be lower on the scale than me. However, the list does not justify you or anyone else before God. If we go to John chapter 6, Jesus is teaching the people, and they ask him a question. Now, he just finished telling them, don't seek for food which perishes. And we remember that's right after the loaves and fishes that he multiplied up on the mountainside, gave everybody something to eat. But he said, you better look for the food that endures to eternal life. And so this prompts the people to ask him, what shall we do that we may work the works of God? Now, the people respected the Pharisees for their long list of rules. They didn't follow the rules themselves. They considered them too onerous and too complicated to follow, and they were constantly evolving with rabbinical tradition. And so, although they didn't follow it, they respected the Pharisees for their piety. You know, they make long prayers, they're fussy about tithing, they're fussy about what to do on the Sabbath, they're fussy about a thousand things. And so what they're doing here is they're asking Jesus for his list. What should we do to work the works of God? His list is remarkably short. This is the work of God, that you believe in him whom he has sent. That's it, one thing. I want you to believe in the Messiah that God has sent. Elsewhere, we see Jesus saying, why do you call me Lord, Lord, but don't do what I say? In those days, many teachers had disciples that were followers, and they'd learn from the teacher, they'd imitate the teacher. It's like the old apprentice journeyman master pattern that remains with us to this day. So the apprentice comes in and starts learning. The journeyman can do some work under the supervision of the master, and the master, when he gets that good, can have apprentices and journeymen under him. And so the Christian disciple, we are an apprentice or a journeyman. We desire to do what Jesus would do in any given case and to encourage other people to do the same. And so there's a desire there to be like him and learn more and more, so growth can be measured by similarity to what Jesus would have done in any case. From the text we have studied, it seems pretty clear that someone who hungers and thirsts after righteousness is going to want to do the works of God. And the first and foremost work from these texts is to believe in the one God sent. And this is what Paul is talking about when he talks about suffering the loss of all things because of his transformation from a zealous Pharisee into a zealous Christian. He was zealous in both cases, but his feet were on the wrong path in the first place. He met Jesus on the road to Damascus, and after that meeting, Paul was never the same. Having come to know Christ, his desire is to know him better, along with the power of his resurrection and the fellowship of his sufferings. Think of Nicodemus that came to Jesus by night. He knew Jesus came from God because of the signs that were done. Those signs spoke for themselves. Now, he did his best to obey the law and try to be religious with the light and the knowledge he had. But by coming, he showed a desire to know more. What could Jesus tell him? What did Jesus tell him? You must be born again. From these things, I believe a man who hungers and thirsts after righteousness is a man who first wants to believe in, know, and follow Jesus. And having done this, having started his feet on the right path, he desires to know more. So, if we reduce the idea of hunger and thirst to a need for bread and water, we have later teachings from Jesus that he was the bread that came down from heaven. He said, your fathers ate the manna in the wilderness, but they died. But the bread that comes down from heaven can lead you to eternal life. To the Samaritan woman at the well, he spoke of living water that springs up out of the heart like a spring and flows. This verse also contains a promise. Those who hunger and thirst after righteousness shall be satisfied or shall be filled. The Christian is a person who has followed the command of Jesus to believe on the one who the Father sent. And with this belief comes an inward drive, a curiosity, a desire to know what Jesus taught, what he did. And the question foremost in mind is, well, what should I do? What shall I do today, tomorrow, next week, next month? What shall I do? The Christian belongs to Christ and is indwelt by the Holy Spirit. And so, like the Bereans, who earnestly studied the scriptures to see if these things were so, the Christians also desires to study and see. Now, some of us are more studious than others. That's a fact. Some of us are more interested in studying books and things like that, and some less so. But all of us can study to the extent of our ability, and that's all that can be expected. And so the Christian's desires to study and see, take the principles of the gospel and apply them in day-to-day life. See where it takes you. In the study then of the scriptures, and in the practice of then doing the things so studied, we can see the satisfaction of those who hunger and thirst after righteousness, which is kind of shorthand for being a disciple, taking the following of Jesus Christ seriously to imitate him in the things you do in daily life. And so, as we go our separate ways, I would advise each and every one to do that, because those who hunger and thirst after righteousness will be satisfied. Our closing hymn, "O to Be Like Thee," by the way, is number 387, not 378. You know, someone got careless with their fingers, I think.